Coming to you from Houston, Texas, NACE International, the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, brings you the Flint Phenomenon Part 2. NACE International is a not-for-profit association that equips society to protect people, assets, and the environment from the adverse effects of corrosion. Here are your hosts, Ben DeBose and Sammy Miles.
Episode 2 of the Flint Phenomenon podcast series, brought to you by Corrosion Journal. I'm Ben DeBose, staff writer with NACE Publications.
And I'm Sammy Miles, the managing editor-in-chief of Corrosion Journal.
We spent the first episode of our series looking back at the recent water crisis in Flint, Michigan, with two very distinguished panelists, those being Virginia Tech engineering professor Mark Edwards and Environmental Protection Agency engineer Darren Lytle.
Now, in episode 2, we're going to continue exploring all the lessons learned from Flint, but this time from a slightly more technical perspective. In this episode, our panelists Mark and Darren are joined by Dr. John Scully, the technical editor-in-chief for Corrosion Journal and the department chair at the University of Virginia's Center for Electrochemical Science and Engineering.
Like the first episode, this discussion was also taped earlier this year at NACE's annual corrosion conference. Anyway, without further delay, let's play back that conversation. Here's Dr. Scully.
First, thanks, Darren, and thanks, Mark, for being here. You know, the city of Chicago gets to do 50 water samples a year over the entire city just at their choice. And what do you think about some kind of online monitoring as opposed to batch monitoring? Anybody, either Mark or Darren?
I am about monitoring. So, you know, going above and beyond is a recommendation that we make to everyone, and particularly, you know, when they know they're going to make a change to their distribution system or their source water or their treatment, whatever it may be. And so, you know, whether it's online, certain parameters can of course be monitored online, or taking grab samples on a routine basis. And as I said, you know, broadening out maybe what is required in doing a little bit more in the way of, you know, just getting a better feel and a better handle for what's happening in our distribution system. And again, I go back to, you know, when a change is made, you need to be able to pick up any potential impacts, unintended consequences or what have you in the distribution system as rapidly as possible, you know, react accordingly. So again, monitoring is the key to that. And there's monitoring of various water quality parameters and what those are, things like turbidity, let's say, and iron, and of course, pH, and your disinfectant residual, and other things. There would be indicators of problems, but then also too monitoring of lead and not just, you know, the required lead and copper monitoring, but, you know, other things that might be more sensitive, like the sequential profiling sampling that I mentioned earlier.
And I just want to mention, though, that in terms of monitoring the actual problem, which is lead in water, that there are kind of chemical and physical barriers that are almost insurmountable. And specifically, the key issue is that you're talking about something in water at a part per billion level as a recalcitrant particle in many cases. And so you can imagine a lead phosphate piece of rust falling off a pipe, and your health concern is at 5 ppb, 10 ppb, 100 ppb. And how exactly can you detect that when it's falling off at a random or semi-random interval? And that to me seems, you know, if we were dealing with soluble lead in water, we think we'd have a shot at that. But trying to detect 1, 2, 5, 10 ppb of a recalcitrant particle that, you know, falls off here and there, it's really a logistical and analytical nightmare. And I don't see how anyone's going to overcome that without, you know, in real time.
Yeah. That's right. And we get, you know, and believe me, I mean, since Flint in particular, I mean, we, you know, a number of folks have come to us with online, potentially online lead monitoring devices, or field test kits and things like that. And I would say that all of them, they may be effective and good, but it's the soluble that they're getting at. You know, a lot of them are based on electrochemical approaches and things like that. And what Mark is pointing to, the particle part.
That's a really good point. And so I just wanted to ask you that, you know, you have to let the soluble lead, you're right, like microelectrodes electrochemically to measure like 10 to the minus 8 molar concentration has been measured with the microelectrode. But then when you have a particle falling off, you know, what's the silver bullet? How do we develop the technology that can measure that?
I mean, they're certified, but they're properly certified by NSF to remove both particulate and soluble lead. And so if you think about that, and if you put one of those on a household tap for a period of time, you're trapping both particulate and soluble lead. So we're looking at using that idea as a sampling device. Now, it's not instantaneous. I don't know how we ever get there, but certainly over a period of time, you know, if we put that onto a kitchen tap where people drink and cook from, you know, that might be a better indicator, at least overall in that period of time, kind of an average lead concentration, both particulate and soluble, that's gone through the faucet. So you know, that's the kind of thing we're kind of looking at, and we're using that as a tool for hopefully identifying lead service lines, working with our folks in Region 5 to apply it in that way, but also it's maybe a better tool for getting at maybe even exposure-type sampling. You know, so those are the kinds of things we're looking at. But again, it's not, you know, that instantaneous kind of thing is, yeah, that's a challenge.
Right, because you see in other countries, like in Denmark, where they tax water heavily, they have like a smart cities cyber physical systems approach where they actually can do online monitoring. But it's not necessarily for lead. In their case, they're doing, you know, monitoring for something else. And they do online monitoring, potentially seeing whether you have some sort of chronic or acute situation as
yeah.
far as something in the water.
Well, right. And you're right, probidimeters, you know, I mean, these things are, you know, things like that that could be installed at various locations in the distribution system. Indicators of impact or you know, problems that are happening in a broader sense, you know, not necessarily lead, but there's indicators of upset of some sort could certainly be valuable.
Just in terms of lead phosphate, I just wanted to ask you both a question about how much is understood about lead phosphate working as an inhibitor as opposed to the baseline understanding that you should add lead phosphate. I mean, for instance, they know that things like Portland, Oregon, that limestone won't work, that limestone doesn't get you at a lead soluble lead concentration below the lead and copper rule. And that lead phosphate, it seems like there's a lot that could be advanced in understanding. I don't think that people know sort of the what I would call the material science of lead phosphate inhibitor. For instance, if you form a film on the surface, what does that film look like? What is the film crystallography? What is the relationship with the lead surface? If you have a corrosion product on the pipe already, what's the relationship with that? And then how effective is lead phosphate?
Phosphates are added in about 50% of water supplies generally to control the lead. And it does work very, very effectively, especially on the soluble lead and eventually on the particulate lead. So there's no doubt it can dramatically improve in this band-aid corrosion control approach to trying to broadly reduce lead while we figure out better solutions, such as replacing the lead pipe. And there's been a lot of work showing when and how effective it is, but in terms of the details, certainly more needs to be done. And one of the things we're looking at is just, is this bioavailable? And, you know, some of these lead phosphates are so incredibly insoluble that in theory, you could ingest them and a large portion of them might pass through your body and not elevate your blood lead, for example. But, you know, these are very difficult questions that we're not going to sort out anytime soon.
I'll add to that. I mean, I think when it comes to understanding the kind of the fundamental chemistry and geochemistry of lead phosphates, I think that's, you know, there's a lot out there. But as I was sort of indicating earlier, you know, when we actually look at pipe scales and corrosion byproducts on lead service lines, you know, there's a lot of other stuff happening there. And so for the phosphate to be effective, you know, it's got to go through a lot of other stuff to be effective. And so there's a lot that we don't understand there. And I'll also add, and maybe Mark can speak to this a little bit too, but, you know, we've been talking all about lead service lines here for most of this conversation, but there are other sources of lead, you know, in galvanic corrosion, you know, leaded solders and brasses. We can't ignore those either. I mean, I understand that certainly if you have a lead service line, that's the major source to deal with. But, you know, I think, you know, and maybe Mark, some of Mark's work has shown too that, you know, maybe the phosphates aren't as effective for those types of situations. And so there are some things I think we need to understand within premise plumbing as well, the role of phosphates.
Right, and that's a really good point, because you know there's other sources of lead, and mm-hmm. some of those lead phosphate, I mean, or phosphates may not be effective. So if you have solder joints, I mean, is it known, you know, where the in addition to where the lead lines are, where the I saw some articles recently where people use artificial intelligence to sort of predict where the lead lines might be as a substitute for real information. They were able to say that houses built in a certain age period or a certain time period, and a number of other factors will be highly likely to have lead solder or to have a lead line itself.
Yeah, it's our strategies for identifying which particular homes will have lead solder or lead and brass are better in terms of demarcating the risk. And in general, if you have metallic plumbing before 1986, you probably do have lead solder, but after that, you should not. And if you have lead and brass in your home, which most homes do up until 2014, it was made with relatively high lead in the brass added to it to make it easier to manufacture. And then the standards were tightened a lot after 2014. But ironically, even the toughest standards that we just put in 2014 are not considered good enough now in the aftermath of Flint, that you could actually go out and replace an entire school's plumbing system meeting the existing plumbing code and the new 2014 standard. And you could not guarantee that you're meeting some of the new recommendations for lead and water, which some folks are putting at around one part per billion. And so it's going to create, you know, real dilemmas, because the expectations of lead and water are dropping so fast. Our plumbing code is always behind it. And I think that's a shame, because if you can't fix the problem by putting in brand new plumbing to everyone's satisfaction, what then? The only option is bottled water or filters, and I don't think that's a long-term solution. So we've got so many ethical dilemmas and cost-benefit analyses coming to play here. It's really, you know, scary. But the biggest problem is the lead pipe, because that is the government-owned source. And to some extent, if it weren't for that, you could say it's the consumer's responsibility, that like lead paint, it's in your house. You have to figure out how to deal with it on your own, and we'll help you do that. But once you have a government-owned source of lead that directly affects a product intended for human consumption, you have a responsibility to deal with that. And so for that reason, most of the attention is appropriately focused on what to do with these lead pipes.
You know, there's a sort of public policy part, the government part, and there's the scientist part, what the scientists can do. Do you see any silver bullets for that? I mean, I just see that there's a very modest amount of lead phosphate research. So let's just assume you have lead lines. What more can be done in lead phosphate research? And do you see any technological silver bullets?
The filters are extremely effective in the intermediate term for folks that have a lead pipe, who think they have a lead pipe. The whole idea that you could eliminate your concerns about this problem for what it would cost to take one sample, say $30 every 6 months, and only treat the water used for cooking or drinking. It's really hard to imagine that we can come up with something better than that to give folks 100% effectively peace of mind in relation to lead and water, not just taking care of the lead pipe, but the solder and the brass. And I wish there was some other kind of silver bullet out there. I don't really like the idea of having to install these filters, but when you look at the cost benefit, it's hard to even imagine something that's more cost effective than that in the intermediate term until we can replace the lead in the plumbing.
I have some questions about the lead phosphate. The limited work that we've done at University of Virginia, we see that the lead, when you add a phosphate, orthophosphate, that it takes a long time even for the inhibitor to work. And I know you can pass when you do some sort of batch sampling long term down the road. But we find just electrochemically, we monitor this very carefully in situ, that the lead phosphate, actually, we're shocked. It takes a long time to work. So just in contrast, when you look at something like chromate inhibitor, which is used in aircraft, it works literally on cracks in microseconds, whereas the lead phosphate film, we found, takes months to build up. This is just in some recent research that we've done. So even if you know you have a lead line and you have filtering and then you have lead phosphate, you're doing everything you can do. We were surprised to learn that the scale doesn't develop for a long time.
Certainly, we observed the same thing both in the lab, but certainly in the field, full scale. I mean, it can take, years before you fully, there's a gradual improvement, but before you fully recognize the benefits. And again, I think that kind of goes back to, the messiness of the scale and other things that could scavenge the phosphate and helping it to get where it needs to get to could, certainly interfere and slow things down there as well. So yeah, sometimes there's an expectation maybe that you're going to see this instant response, and that's not necessarily the case. I think
right.
too.
And merit in work that would look at the enhancing the phosphate as an inhibitor, like a surfactant, something that I guess obviously people can put in the water system and tolerate that improves that scale formation. I don't know if there's any kind of silver bullet there. You still have the particle effect, which is a point well taken. But, is there any way in improving the scale? I just don't see much research being done in this area. And given the public health concern, I'm surprised.
Well, I think making sure that you're at the appropriate dose and you're at the, the optimal pH, certainly can help, move things along. And again, going back to the treatment facility, making sure that, that you're treating the water, you don't have any issues with, let's say, potential for post-precipitation of phosphate-based materials like aluminum phosphates or other things. And I think, too, we got to think about a lot of places are not just adding straight orthophosphates. There's this polyphosphate out there, and so what's the role of the polyphosphate? And I think that's a whole, whole big research question there. What are the roles of phosphates? What are the roles of the polyphosphates when it comes to lead complexation or particle transport issues and things like that too? So we have to kind of understand chemically, what it is that we're adding and what those things have to do with lead release and particulate release.
And then you have to realize this is such a conservative industry, and with good reason, that there's only about 10 chemicals we can add to water that mm-hmm. don't raise public health alarm. Mm-hmm. And even amongst those 10, there are groups who are dead set against them being used. So, for example, you have a very strong lobby out there that feels adding fluoride to water is a horrible, horrible idea. You have groups that are against the idea of adding phosphates to the water in the first place. You have groups that don't want any chemicals in water. Even there's resistance sometimes to chlorine, the taste and the itchiness and the smell of it, even though if we didn't add it, millions of people would die. And so, the idea of coming up with a new chemical sounds good in practice, but in reality, it's not going to happen, because unless you have a very long track record, people never want to be the first to get a new chemical. And that resistance is getting, only stronger. And you just think, what does it take to prove that something added to a water supply is safe with virtual 100% certainty? It's a very high hurdle to overcome.
That's a really good point. But is that decided at the local level or at the national level? In other words, like the 10-color, can a municipality decide whether to do something like that, or is that something that's federally decided?
In terms of what material, what's being added, you mean?
Right. Say you decide, make a decision to add chlorine or make a decision to add a surfactant that enhances the effect of phosphate. Would that be decided at the federal level, or would that be decided locally?
Well, let me back up and just say too, just to reiterate what Mark was saying. I mean, Mark probably remembers. I mean, the whole phosphate issue in Flint was a big one. I mean, there was a period of time, if you recall that, they were adding 1 mg/L worth of phosphate is what the Detroit water source had, and the recommendations were to bump that up and to just over 3 mg/L. And there was a lot of concerns. As Mark said, the industry and the communities are very conservative when it comes to these things. And so there was a lot of concerns about what is this phosphate doing? Is this, so there was an effort for a period of time there where we had to, educate, and make people aware, that these levels of phosphate are not crazy high and not of a health concern. So we were always up against things like that that we just need to be aware of. In terms of decisions that are made, when it comes to whether a community adds orthophosphate or silicate or whatever it is, you know, ultimately, I mean, that decision is approved by the states that have primacy. So, you know, if Community A wants to, in Ohio, wants to, you know, wants to switch the corrosion inhibitor from a blended phosphate, let's say, to an orthophosphate, and, you know, they work with their state to get that approval.
There's a situation in Maine where I know you've heard that they want to use limestone and they're not using phosphate. And the state legislature has approved this, and they already know that it won't work because the lead concentration will not meet the lead and copper rule.
Yeah, I can't speak to that specific situation because I'm not sure what you're referring to. I don't know what to say. But
well, I think Maine, just in short, and I hope I don't get this wrong, but lead, there are lead service lines in the state of Maine, and they have elected not to use phosphate, from what I understand, or orthophosphate. Polyphosphates, they've decided that they're going to add limestone to the water. And, you know, there's already evidence to show that just the soluble lead concentration in equilibrium with some sort of corrosion product with lead formed from limestone will not meet the lead and copper rule. And that's how I understand the problem.
Well, I mean, I would certainly agree that pH adjustment, if you look at lead solubility, you know, you're going to be able to get much lower in lead if you're adding, you know, an orthophosphate as opposed to trying to manage things with pH adjustment. But, you know, the key, I think, there too is understanding what materials there are in a distribution system. You know, I think if you have lead service lines, you know, it's one thing. But if you don't have lead service lines in that community, and certainly we've seen people with success by raising the pH, that when a source of lead is in that service line, but rather the components, you know, in the solder or in the brasses, we've certainly seen people with success with pH adjustment, you know, in managing those situations. So, yeah, I think that the materials inventory is kind of important. And again, you know, going back to extra monitoring and things like that to make sure that that's the best approach.
So I have a question for the group. Are there any other cities currently experiencing similar problems to Flint? And do you think that there'll be a few more? We touched on this a little bit earlier, but are there any specifics that are currently having this problem or are trying to figure out how they're going to prevent it in the next 5 years?
Well, there are literally hundreds of systems that are failing to meet the lead action level around the country. Generally, they're not the larger cities, but we still have, for example, Portland, Oregon, who's chronically exceeded the lead and copper rule by failing to implement appropriate corrosion control. In the aftermath of Flint, the only thing that we discovered was about Flint that was unusual is that the problem got discovered and it grew into this national and international media sensation. Obviously, that has to do with the political sort of decisions that were made, the fact that this is the poorest city in America, that it was being run by the government under a bankruptcy situation. And for all those reasons, it did deserve to get the coverage. But what happened there is really not atypical, except for the fact that the system was being run by the state, that federal law was being broken in terms of there literally was not a corrosion control plan in place. And then you had the additional malfeasance wherein once the problem was discovered by residents and an EPA employee, that appropriate steps were not taken quickly enough to satisfy anyone.
So talking about Flint, what still needs to be addressed in the city? How are things doing now?
Well, you know, EPA has implemented probably amongst the best corrosion control programs in the United States. And so I don't think there's much more that can be done there. And what needs to be done is have these old antiquated pipes replaced. But the big problem you have is money. Flint is the poorest city in America, but they also have amongst the highest water rates in America. And many of my friends there actually pay more for their water bills than their mortgage. So the biggest problems is what I call the infrastructure death spiral, wherein once your water bills are so high, people start to leave the city. And because people are leaving the city, the water prices go up further because there's less people paying for it. And your ability to upgrade that system is also diminished. And so Flint is still in the midst of a water infrastructure crisis, like thousands of towns around America who simply can't afford to maintain their existing system, much less improve it. So even though, you know, the lead situation is now returned to a normal level where there's now 70 cities in Michigan that have more lead in water than Flint, you still have the problem with very high water bills, no ability to upgrade their infrastructure, and a complete and total loss of trust in the water system, and that many residents are still using bottled water, not just for drinking, but also for bathing, because they are so afraid that what happened before might happen again, and they're just not going to take that risk.
Yeah, that's a pretty daunting situation, because 70% of American cities, kind of overall, I understand, have lead service lines. Are there any other solutions? Like, for instance, just if you had the Department of Defense developed a corrosion simulator, and so people could play this game and see what the outcome would be of certain choices. And this was a user game that would be something that could inform people, assuming you didn't have malfeasance like you had in Flint, Michigan. If you had a game simulator in some city to see what the impact of your certain choices would be, do you think that would be of any value? In other words, you play the game and see what the outcome is as far as lead concentration in the water based on your choices that you made in your management of the local water system.
Well, I think the biggest problem is the lack of predictability, in that a lot of these systems are almost inherently unpredictable using our best science. And so our approach is really trial and error, wherein hopefully you do the trial and error in a jar or in a desktop study before you make the change in the city. But even when you implement a change based on a trial and error with a modicum of scientific experience and wisdom as a guide, you have to be monitoring it to make sure that things don't go wrong. And so I think that inherent scientific uncertainty, because of our lack of knowledge and the incredible, I mean, these are just incredibly complicated systems and incredibly complicated scientific problems, you would really have a hard time sort of making a game up that could capture the reality.
Why markets are so unpredictable?
Well, because we just don't understand like how each change in the water is going to affect each of the different lead sources that are out there. Every one of them behaves fundamentally differently. You have pure lead pipe. You have galvanized iron, which has a zinc coating with lead in it. You have solder that's galvanically coupled to copper. You have lead and brass, which is an alloy situation. So you have four distinctly, totally different potential sources of lead in terms of how they respond to individual chemistry changes or inhibitors. You've got situations where you can add this chemical to the water and make lead service line lead better and increase lead coming from solder. And then realize that every single home is different.
Yeah.
It has different lead in the plumbing. It has different water use patterns. So, you know, you have some homes where people are hardly using any water. Some people are using a lot. Those are two totally different scenarios. You've got microbes influencing these problems. And every individual house has a different microbial profile. You've got different pipes going to each house. So if you have a concrete pipe going to your house versus an unlined iron pipe, that's totally different as well.
You got park water differences, right? I mean, you got source water differences, you got treatment changes, you got seasonal variations, you have mixing zones, you have, you know, all kinds of temperature changes, all kinds of things. It's so complicated.
Those are all really good points. And so I see what you're trying to say, that, you know, what I'm surprised from a science standpoint, I looked online one time, but there's very, very few sort of funded projects in this area. I'm thinking more of National Science Foundation, but I shouldn't probably name the agencies, but it just seems like there's a fairly modest level of research in this area, and I'm surprised.
Yeah, and there may be some things coming out. You know, really, I think it just points to the fact that each system has to do their best to understand their system. You know, and that's where, again, comes in, you know, the added monitoring. You know, do they have, you know, are there pipe rigs, for example, installed that they can use to assess things? You know, doing your homework up front, you know, and if you are going to make changes down the road, you need to think about those things early, well before the change is made. And then if you do make the change, be prepared to monitor and diagnose and find problems. So every system is unique. And, you know, the pipe scales are unique. The waters are unique. And usage patterns on homes are all unique.
And the other thing is, why invest in something that you want to go extinct? That's a big concern. So the idea, the ultimate solution is only to replace these lead pipes. And so given that reality, every time you want to propose a research project to study this, we're appropriately criticized, well, isn't the answer just to replace these lead pipes in the first place? And you have to answer yes, you know, but the thought that we're going to get these lead pipes out of the ground in the next 10 or 20 years, it's not going to happen. You know, this is a problem that's not going to be resolved in my lifetime. But you are up against these philosophical arguments that it is 100% certain that, you know, the way forward is to replace these pipes. Given that reality, why are you wasting time trying to understand something that a problem you want to go extinct?
Right. And that's a really good point. I would just say that there are parallels to other situations. Like I can say an aging aircraft, for instance, or, you know, there are materials that are not immune to cracking. There are some major cracking problems, environmental cracking in an aircraft that affect, I'm not going to name them, but current airframes right now. But, you know, the ability to replace those is not realizable near term. And so those systems are going to be managed. Same with a lot of systems. Nuclear reactors have corrosion problems, and they're not going to be able to replace those. In fact, they'll try to do service life extensions. And so, you know, in this situation, as you point out, Mark, and lead, the research, I don't make the policy, but it could be, you know, it's not financially viable to replace it all, right? And there isn't enough financial resource around to replace it. And then if you pointed out in some of your articles, this partial lead replacement can even be worse.
And then, as we said earlier, how do you even find them to replace them? You know, we've got 10, 15 years of work to even find where these lead pipes are, even if we rolled up our sleeves and committed ourselves to it tomorrow.
Right.
I've seen some papers recently using artificial intelligence to try to predict where the lead pipe would be in lieu of actual record keeping. I think some of that might be fruitful. Just saying, like, if it was in a certain area, in a certain time period where the house is built, and some other factors, trying to predict with reasonable reliability where there might be lead pipe based on certain records. What would you both recommend that communities do, given this unpredictability in water chemistry, unpredictability of the myriad of variables that you point out in water systems?
What was the question again, in terms of what?
Well, so you pointed out very well the you know, the unpredictability that you can't, you know, I asked earlier about making a game simulator that tells you the impact of various, you know, policies as far as, you know, water management. And mm-hmm. You pointed out that there's so many variables, yeah. A lot of them unknown. And so that's a point well taken. But then what should communities do to protect themselves?
I kind of go back to, you know, thinking about ways that they can monitor kind of above and beyond, you know, the regulatory requirements. So the more information that they can gather, you know, in using tools such as, you know, pipe rigs, for example. I mean, if you could put pipe rigs in place and had them in place, you know, for years, you know, just, you know, running, you know, automated running perhaps in a facility, you know, that's a tool that they could use to assess, you know, treatment changes in advance of making the changes. And again, you know, monitoring the distribution system in ways such as when it comes to lead, maybe, you know, thinking about things like sequential profiling, sampling, and potentially other approaches to get a better handle as to what's happening within homes. And then water stability is, you know, always a big one for us. I mean, don't minimize changes in the distribution system in terms of the distribution system water quality, minimize fluctuations and some of the important parameters that impact, you know, corrosion control in lead and copper.
So I have a question for the group. We've been focusing on the water infrastructure, but what do y'all think the next Flint will be? Like, what will be the next crisis that we have facing the nation? Not in terms of lead pipe, but are there other similar type of problems that we see that the country's moving towards when the U.S. internationally? I know John touched on a few of them with aerospace, but are there any other issues that y'all see that we need to start investigating?
Well, Flint was ahead of the curve in terms of going bankrupt. And there are literally thousands of American cities who are following in their footsteps, cities that are losing population and that are entering this infrastructure death spiral. And at present, we don't know how to manage such decline. We don't have mechanisms short of a water disaster to get outside money to help those folks meet federal drinking water laws. And so I really see this as a, you know, an absolute problem that, that is coming our way, and we do not have a paradigm to deal with it. What we're talking about is situations where cities and towns might be destined to become ghost towns. You know, this has happened throughout American history, and we have this mega trend of folks leaving the country and going to cities that are on the coast. And what do we do with the folks who are left behind and who have a limited ability to pay, and their bills are going up? Because unlike roads, for example, that are degraded slower the less people use them, water systems in many cases actually degrade faster the less you use them, and they're actually designed for a certain number of people. So this is creating an issue all around the country, and you know what we're going to do about that mess, I really have no idea.
What do you both see as a, I know there's not a remedy for that immediately obvious, but what do you see as from, at all levels, from a science level, from a public policy, what do you see as the solution to something like that?
Well, it could be anything from just telling these folks that they're no longer part of a first world country and that they're no longer being protected by federal laws because they can't afford to, and just tell them that they're on their own. I mean, at least that's being honest. We should not continue with the worst of all worlds, which is to tell people they're being protected by federal law when they're not. That's the tragedy of Flint. And the only alternative beyond that is to get outside resources so that state or federal money can be used to support municipalities so they can maintain their water infrastructure. But right now, those programs do not exist. Our paradigm is you get the water you can afford. Period. And so, you know, I'm very much a pragmatist, and, you know, whichever path we go, I mean, that's fine. There's arguments to be made either way. But what I think I personally cannot tolerate is telling people that they're being protected by federal law, that their water's fine, when that's really not the case.
Right. And that's the point that you make there is kind of a non-negotiable, telling people that their water's fine when it's not. That's got to be a non-negotiable point. Mm-hmm. You know, as far as a solution, it's a lot tougher. You know, so that's pretty sort of a somber reality. Unless there's some sort of technological silver bullet that comes on, or a bypass. You can imagine some situations, there are things that come along, technologies that sort of bypass the problem. And I don't know what that is in this instance. So it would be like in the idea of third world countries not having the ability to communicate, not having good infrastructure for land use of telephones. And then iPhone, you know, if iPhones came along, or, you know, these handheld phones came along and literally totally bypassed, you know, the landline approach. And I don't see a solution like that for water unless you guys do.
Well, in terms of water quality, we have it. We're not willing to adopt it, though, because we can't admit the reality. But, you know, you can have centralized points where there's pickup points in town where the water's treated in an enhanced way to make it suitable for drinking and cooking. And then you could provide water in quantity that is not dangerous for bathing and showering. But we're not prepared to accept that in this country. We want to keep the myth alive that water can come out of the tap completely safe and suitable for all purposes. But that solution does exist, you know, and unfortunately, that's the solution that many Americans are adopting. They no longer trust the water coming out of the tap for cooking and drinking, and they are therefore paying a large amount of money to either purchase in-home treatment systems or bottled water for that purpose. And so that solution is occurring, but it could be occurring in a more systematic and cost-effective way. For example, if a city had a local filling station where they could get bottled water quality folks picking it up in jugs. And that's what's happening in Flint as we speak. Many of my friends there are still buying bottled water from Walmart or Fred Meyer, but from centralized production places where they can get it for 50 cents a gallon.
Yeah, this is an interesting conversation. It's a little, you know, beyond what the kinds of things we're thinking about, but I certainly put in the conversation where this information and in discussions were being had. I mean, we know, I mean, we treat our water, we can treat our water to a very high level, but, you know, when it enters that old aging infrastructure system, you know, things can happen, and, you know, corrosion and things accumulate in our distribution system that can be released back to the water. So that's a huge, huge challenge. I can recall, you know, some conversations people talked about, like Mark was saying, fill up stations or even like the old, you know, when I was a kid, you know, the milkman would come to the house, you know, once a week and leave milk in the front. I mean, you know, is that going to be water in the future? I don't know, you know, but it's just an interesting, you know, and big issue, certainly, that we need to think about.
Right.
It's not necessarily unattainable. When I lived in the Southwest, and it's an interesting thing versus living in Virginia, the water, a community invested in water and paid a homeowner's fee to have a water tank. And I lived in New Mexico. And so it's more along the lines of what Mark's saying. Water, you didn't expect water out of the tap. It's just readily available for all purposes that you might be interested in as a homeowner. And so it's a little bit of a different paradigm. Having maintaining as a community, everyone was invested in having this water tank. And that's sort of a different approach to the idea of water's free and it's available from the tap. But it's alive and well as a strategy in the Southwest for other reasons.
Good conversation there between our three panelists. Again, that's Dr. John Scully of Corrosion Journal and the University of Virginia, engineering professor Mark Edwards of Virginia Tech, and EPA engineer Darren Lytle.
We thank them for their time, and we also thank you for listening. We appreciate you for checking out our new podcast series, and if you haven't subscribed yet, please do. More episodes are planned in the weeks and months ahead.
For now, though, this is where we will leave things. Once again, thanks for joining us, and please come back soon for more episodes in our brand new NACE podcast series.